Okay, cool. So I was told to give this lecture of integrals over unitary matrices, or in particular, Appendix D of 1409, 1231, which is Dan Harlow's lectures on black holes and information. The content of Appendix D, so this will be a very quick lecture, if we just take it as it is. So this is the first equation. This is the second equation. And then this is the third equation. This one takes a couple of seconds to write. Is pretty awful. And then, I don't know if there's a fourth equation, but you can imply, you can assume that there's some sort of dot, dot, dot. So I think I'm tasked with explaining what this means, and then hopefully ways of understanding how to derive these sorts of formulas, and maybe a better representation of them, because so these are just sort of awful. So let me explain what they are, what we're trying to do. And actually, I thought the motivation was going to be in place and that Daniel is going to tell you something and then I was going to prove it. But I guess I'll reverse the order and instead just tell you the thing at the end and then prove it. And then it'll be exciting after a math lecture. So this will basically be a math lecture. So what is the point? Let's say there's the unitary group U of D, and you want to sample from the unitary group with uniformly over the group and compute some sort of quantity that involves unitary matrices. A reason for doing this, as we'll get into, is this: if you want to, say, have a random quantum circuit, a random channel, or a random state, this is the sort of thing you do. So you would form these, the thing, form the quantity that you want to compute, and then take some sort of average. It'll involve some number of unitary matrices. You then inspect these formulas. So here's how I learned it. This is a statement that the measure is normalized, sort of nice and straightforward. And the next thing you learn is that the, you look this up, but you're told that you need to have the same number of U's and U daggers. The reason basically being is that the measure has to be unitarily invariant. And so with one copy of U and one copy of U dagger, this is the only sort of structure that you can convince yourself is unitarily invariant. And then by taking the trace of this, you can, and recovering the fact that it's normalized, you get this 1 over D. And then you go and you ask about the next moment, and you don't know what you're doing, so you're told just to look it up. So you look it up, and then you write down this expression. And then you want to compute something higher, you're told to look it up, but you can't even find it in a table because it's just completely ugly and disgusting. And so you just give up. And in fact, most people never need something more than 2. So so let's not do that. Instead, there has to be a better way. Let's talk through a better way. So we're just going to try and derive some sort of general expression for integrals over unitary matrices, and then we'll apply it to something actually in physics. Does the setup sort of make sense? Any questions so far? I didn't really explain anything yet. Okay, cool. And I should say that the presentation I'm following is very indebted to Benny Yoshida, who just wrote up, well, it'll appear in a paper of ours that's forthcoming, but Benny wrote up a very nice introduction to this that I'm following pretty closely. So at some point, you'll be able to hopefully read that if this lecture goes poorly. So let's see. This is called the Haar measure. And so the statement, the first math statement is that the Haar measure is the unique probability measure that's both left and right invariant. So what does that mean? So that means, first of all, it's a probability measure. So we've derived this equation, check. And so it means that if I consider the integral of some function of u, where I act with some unitary v from the left, or I consider the integral some function of u where I act with v from the right, that this is equal to du f of u. So that's the statement I wrote in English above. We're going to use this 3 or 4 times, or maybe twice. We'll use this. So that's why you put a box around it. So good. So now, yeah.
So maybe you say that there's some probability that that's up to 1, but is there some condition for it being positive or something like that?
That might be a more technical question than I'm at liberty to answer, but I mean, this is just a we're exploring what we mean by the symbol, which is the probability measure, right? So we're trying to define a probability measure that has the appropriate properties that it samples uniformly from the unitary group. And we're demanding that it be unitarily invariant. So we demand this. This is what it means to be a measure. And the thing we're going to develop is the unique thing that has that property. And so we're going to, in some sense, define it by what it means to integrate over various moments. Go ahead.
The measure by definition should be probably
non-negative. Yeah, yeah. Right, I'm saying, sorry, yes. The measure should be non-negative, but I'm saying, like, writing the symbol is, like, we have to explore what it means, and that's sort of the point of the lecture, as opposed to there being hidden non-negativity in there or something. Okay, so so in anticipation of the sort of thing that we're going to, so the idea, the approach is going to be is we're going to try and pick some function f that is going to have enough freedom to basically explore all the moments of these integrals that we want and develop a nice representation for what that looks like. So some of you might recognize why this is the right thing to start with. Or not, but I'll try to explain it in a second. But for the moment, let's just pick f of u to be this particular function. So I'm going to take k copies of u, dagger, and then with some operator a, and then another k copies of u. So I'm conjugating some operator a. So I guess I should say that, right, so we're considering a Hilbert space that's d-dimensional, so we're integrating over, or we're considering the measure on the unitary group in d dimensions, and now we're taking k copies of that. So this is an enlarged Hilbert space, and A acts on that enlarged d to the k dimensional Hilbert space, so it's some sort of linear operator, and so we're just considering this function f. And, right, so there's another technical thing that maybe some of you are familiar with. So this is related to something called the k-fold twirl of an ensemble. So what is that? That's given by this function phi of A. So now I'm talking about a general ensemble, not necessarily the whole unitary group. So I'm summing over the elements of the ensemble with some probability pi. I take k copies of u dagger, a, and then I take another k copies of u. So this is called, I didn't make up the name, but this is called the k-fold twirl of an ensemble. If k is one, this is basically a channel where we take some operator u and we put it through, sorry, take some operator a and we put it through a channel of u. This is some generalized thing where we have k copies of the channel and we, when k equals one, we basically apply unitary ui with probability p to the operator. And so that's some sort of generic channel. In this is a generalization where we have this enlarged Hilbert space where we have these copies, and it's called the k-fold twirl. So the action of the quantum channel is defined by the ensemble E on A for when k is one. Now we can also define this for har, which maybe I don't need to write again, but I will anyway. And I think it's true. I think it's true that if for a given ensemble that these objects agree for all, if these objects agree for all choices of operators A and for basically all K, then that ensemble basically is the Haar ensemble. So this is a way of sort of diagnosing. I mean, it's clear that let's just say it's clear that this integral, right, involves many higher moments of integrals of these sorts, and by choosing A or acting with other operators carefully, we can sort of pick out the integral we want. So the central object of study in the rest of this lecture is going to be an object that looks like this with general A, and then we're going to play around with A to derive formulas that look like this or formulas of interest, and I'll make one statement of relevance to physics. Okay, so we want to find. I should not extemporaneously speak and then read my notes, but so we want to find an explicit formula for this. This is the goal of probably 20 minutes. So to do that, we need to study the properties of this guy and then use that stuff a bunch of times and then introduce something else and then we'll have a nice form. So first, properties. So first is it's invariant under unitary conjugation. So what does that mean? How do I see that, etc. So it's invariant under a specific type of unitary conjugation. So I'm going to conjugate it with k copies of V, where V is any unitary that lives in the d-dimensional Hilbert space. This is what the words I wrote mean. How do we see that? So let's take F to be of that form, and then we can show that V acting on, so we can show that this equals F of V acting on U. So if F is over here, if I act with V inside, then I act with V tensor product K dagger over here and V tensor product K over there. So like this. So it's clear that this is equal to this du, and we know that it's left invariant. So this is just equal to har a. But a simple rearrangement of this is going to show that V tensor product K and the twirl of A commute for all choice of A. Does everybody see where that could come from, or should I explain that further? Okay. So we'll just not make good use of space. It's fine. So the next property of this guy is that I don't have good words of how to say this. The input is invariant under k-fold unitary conjugation. So that's like the other option of the thing you can do, and the one that's going to invoke right invariance. So what does that mean? You take this k-fold twirl, and you act inside here, v to the k, a, v to the k, which is equal to f uv. So it's v acting from the other side. It's basically what it had to be. Du. And so this is going to be, again, just the k-fold twirl back. So by right invariance. So it's invariant under the following conjugations. There'll be a statement I will make that will be analogous to that in a second, but it's easier to make it in a second and not right now. And so at this point, I need to, right. So I guess this is already a math lecture for the most part, but in this case, I need to import some other math that's a little even more formal. So this is theorem one, the Schur-Weil duality. Are you supposed to write math theorems on the board or just say them? I don't know, it's like a half page of English. I haven't been to math class in a while. Okay, well, fine. I'll write it unless people stop me. So let the set of linear operators acting on the Hilbert space tensored to the K be the algebra of all operators, of all the operators acting on H tensor to the K. Let U of H, honestly, I don't know why you used H instead of D here, but fine. Let U of H be the unitary group on H. On H, so an operator A that's part of an element of the linear operators that act on H tensor to the K commutes with all operators V tensor to the K with V an element of the unitary group on H, if and only if A is a linear combination of permutation operators. And I guess, so you can keep writing that, I'll just duck. There's a symbolic statement of this. So if you have that equals zero, this implies that, or bidirectionally implies that A is a sum, a linear combination of elements of the permutation group on K. So for some coefficients C pi, so SK is a symmetric group on K elements. And also note that here, W of pi, so it has an index that says which element of the symmetric group, and it's also an operator on the Hilbert space, on this Hilbert space, because it forms A, so it has various indices, right? So it acts on, good. So let's see, one direction is supposed to be obvious, the other one is supposed to be not obvious to prove, I guess this direction is reasonable to see. So if A consists of operators, if A consists of a sum of permutation operators, the permutation operators, right, have the action of switching these K systems, and if you just have the same operator on all K systems, then it shouldn't matter what order you, whether you act with the operator or whether you permute them, right? The other order is supposed to be hard, so we'll just ignore it. Good. So let's switch the order of these things. Any questions so far, but hopefully not about that? Good. So before the interlude, we precisely derived this fact here. I'll continue over here. Using math, we can rewrite. The twirl as this. So, right, so we derive that, so that means that we know that the answer must be we use the Sure-Weil duality, so we can rewrite this in the following way. So here, these are elements of the permutation group that act on this d to the k dimensional Hilbert space. Pi is an element, s of k, so that indexes which one. This is a linear function on A. And so as a linear function, we can also rewrite it as, maybe I should have just started there. Okay, good. So, let's see. For some operators, C pi. So this is a trace over Hilbert space dimensions. This is just some number. So it's some linear function on A. So it's some number times some operator that acts on Hilbert space. And we sum over these pi's. So we'll just make an equal sign again, just equal sign again. Oops. Sorry, sigma comma pi. So. Sorry, I skipped too far ahead. Apologize. Not allowed to do that yet. Okay, so we're still here. This is some linear function on A, etc. So everybody happy with being here so far? Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, the definition class came. So is W just permuting the factors of H tensor to the K, or is it permuting like the elements, the directions of H tensor to the K in a more complicated way?
No, it's just permuting. It's just permuting the K element. So it's an element of SK, but it's acting on the larger Hilbert space. So right. So if in a swap is the easiest case. So say this is, you know, this has D dimensions and this has D dimensions, okay. Right? And then it's just, that would be an element of S2. And the there's only one other one, which is the identity. So actually there's some implicit, well, not yet. There will be some, I'll say something later, of course, because I'm talking, but I'll say something about this later. Okay, so now we need to go back to being here. So I can just start from there and insert this part about the trace. Apologize for writing this same thing a billion times. So if I act with this sort of right invariant action, or if I conjugate A with these sort of operators V inside here, then I get something that looks like this. And that's going to be equal to, and so it's right invariant, so I can just write this like this, trace of C pi A. So I can, with a, right, so this implies that the C pi commute with the V tensor to the K, the reason being that this is true, so this is an equation is true for all choices of operators A, so that lets me peel off various things, and then I have some statement that if I subtracted from this side and rearranged, it would look like the commutator. Does everybody see that, or should I be more explicit? Everybody's happy with that? Great. So that means it's a candidate for using the Schur-Weil duality again. So using it again, we're able to derive the fact that this twirl is equal to the double sum over pi and sigma elements of the symmetric group C pi sigma W pi trace W sigma A. So let's put box around this because it's almost important. Or maybe a half box or something. Actually, I think I just start it, so maybe we shouldn't have. Don't, if you didn't box it in your notes, don't box it. Just put a star. Right. So good. The next thing I was going to say is, but this is not going to answer your question. C pi sigma is called the Weingarten matrix. But I don't think that's what you were asking. I think what you were asking is, where does it come from? So this fact lets me use this. So C, right, so C already was a linear operator that already had some elements pi, and now it has two indices in the symmetric group, but it's just by applying that formula again. So it's rewriting, it tells me that, right, C pi commutes with all these V tensor to the K, so that means that it itself must be a sum of elements of the symmetric group, right? And so we need to add another index, right? Here, this had no permutation group, sorry, symmetric group indices, right? So we have to add another one and decompose it like that. And so we get some object. I didn't tell you what the object is yet or how to compute it, but there's an object there. So this is sort of almost nice, right? So this is saying that if we want to compute this random Haar integral, we take the trace with an element of the permutation group, we multiply by another element of the permutation group, there's some matrix of coefficients, and we sum over all of them, and that's how we get the answer. Yes?
So I guess addressing what you were saying before, the easy part of seeing why this is true, why the cognitive is equal to this linear span, the easy direction is that that the operator takes all the permutations and linear combinations of those, but the hard part is to show that nothing else can mix with that.
I may have not parsed what you said. The easy way is this way. Probably not. Can somebody who's familiar with this phrase it, maybe?
Communes with all of them, it must be a combination.
I think it's called duality because there's also a statement that if something commutes with all the W pies, then it has to be in the form like a V tensor K as well. So that's why it's like duality.
According to the notes that I was using to produce this lecture, it's related. You have to use von Neumann's double cumulant theorem, but I don't know what that is, and I didn't look that up, so that's why I'm being cagey here. Commutant, not cumulant. Yeah, okay, good. So you guys are ahead of me on this. Good, so we're here. Now we're going to investigate the Weingarten matrix. That's the final step. Maybe this board will I don't know what word I was going to say there. Cooperate, that was the word I was going to say. No, right, because it does this. I don't know if you guys actually, there's a solution to this. It's not going to work.
There's a board over there.
What's that?
On the other wall.
Yeah.
Weight it.
There's weights over here.
Yeah. Pick out the board rubber, use it to weight the...
This.
Yeah. Put it on there, weight it.
I don't think that's going to work.
Put it down.
But, you know, let's see. Oh, this is going to work great. I don't know what this is, so hopefully it's not important if it falls. So note that, right, very softly. So if we take the twirl and we input an permutation operator, we will get a permutation operator. We will get the same permutation operator back out. This is easy to see if you just write down what you actually did. So I will do that. So it must be the case that this is equal to, or it is true that this, whatever, let me finish and then I will talk. Right, so, you know, this, if you permute this, it really doesn't do anything, so it comes out and cancels over here, and then this is unitary, and then so you just invoke it's hiding now, but the property that the measure is by itself integrates to one, and so you get the identity. And so now if I act with W lambda on both sides, then I prove that this is true, right? Okay, so what that means is that using the equation that I accidentally boxed, but just starred, I meant to star, so using star, we can show that, so now we plug this into the formula we were deriving, and the goal here, as I was saying, just to remind you, is to derive a form of this Weingarten matrix. So this is just taking star, putting in W of lambda, and writing what we have. And this implies that sum over sigma C pi comma sigma trace of W sigma W lambda equals delta lambda. Okay, everybody cool with that? And so that implies that the Weingarten matrix is equal to the trace of W sigma, W lambda. Oh, sorry, I messed up my, it should be pi, sorry, quantity to the negative one. For some reason, we're also gonna now label this Q inverse because we are. I have no good reason for that. And Q of lambda sigma is defined to be trace, this trace of two elements of the permutation group. So it's like some sort of trace inner product on this representation. And this is equal to D raised to the number of cycles in the composed permutation. And so if we, I guess now I can start erasing over here. Right. So now we just plug that in, and we get our final answer that you should box. So it's a double sum over two elements of the permutation group. There's this matrix Q. And we take trace of W sigma A. And so this in principle, we know how to do everything because we figure out what our K is, we know what all the elements of the permutation group are, we take trace of various combinations of the operators, and then we have to compute this matrix Q. So why is this form better than that form? I accidentally boxed over there because I told you how to compute Q. Q is related to the choice of permutations and the number of cycles. So I think, yeah. So just to get a feel for what that means, so let's say we want to trace, so let's take the trace of one of these permutations, right? So that should be equal to D times the number of cycles in pi. How do I see that? So let's investigate for K equals 2. So we want to ask the question, so here I have W of pi, and there's two systems. So these lines are like the d-dimensional Hilbert space. So it's d tensor d, and I'm acting with this permutation operator. And I want to take the trace, so I connect these lines. Does everybody understand these sorts of diagrams and what I mean by them? This is just a representation of this. Okay, so there's two elements, right? The options that I can do is I can do nothing, or I can swap. So if I do nothing, then I just complete these lines through, so I get two boxes. And so that's d squared. If I swap, so that means I want to do this. And so this is just d. And so so for the identity, you're just taking 1 and 2. Apparently, this is the notation that people use for these things that I didn't really know about. But so you take 1, 2 to 1, 2. And so there's two cycles here, right? 1 goes to 1, 2 goes to 2. Here, I'm taking systems 1 and 2 to 2 and 1. So I go from 1 to 2, 2 to 1, and then back to 1. So there's one cycle. I think these pictures basically say the same thing. Is it clear why every loop gives you a D, factor of D, to everybody? So this is just supposed to be an example of why this formula is supposed to hold. Okay, cool. So now, good. So now we're done. We've derived the formula for for arbitrary moments of the k-fold twirl. So the things I promised that I would do. Oh, now we can get rid of this. Perfect. Or less perfect. So we derived this one earlier. And so now let's derive the next two by exploring this formula as examples. And then I will have time, hopefully, to get to the interesting physical result. Yeah, go ahead.
Is it that the case where I have a single dimensional Hilbert space and k equals 2?
Yeah, that's right. So that in Q is not invertible. So you shouldn't have done that. So somehow.
Q is not invertible.
What's that?
Why wouldn't it be invertible?
I'll make that clear in like 1 second, but we implicitly, that's right. And this was related to, I think Nick had this question or approached this question earlier, but this is related to, well, the point is that we implicitly assume that K is less than D, or less than or equal to D. So everything I've derived only holds for that. Otherwise, basically you have less elements in the permutation group than you thought you did. Because if your dimension is 1, then you, for instance, don't have the swap, right? You can't swap. Swap is the same as the identity.
But just to be simple, but I can take any permutation which doesn't have a fixed point. And then I think the place should be 0 in this case, because if you write it in any basis, then you get no fixed point of the basis. So the matrix in this basis has only zeros of the diagonal.
Sorry, say that again. You're saying that the trace is 0 of.
If you have no fixed points in your notation.
Okay.
I think the trace should come out 0 because you can think about it as something which is perhaps basis. And then in this base, it doesn't even matter what base.
Sorry, remind me, a fixed point is which?
Is something that the permutation takes to itself when I equals pi r.
When I equals pi I, if there are no such fixed points, so like in this case.
I think like in this case, if you explicitly write down the matrix.
For D, if D is greater than 1, that's not the case. Okay. So like, for instance, we can do that explicitly. So let's say we have D, let's say D is I mean 2 or 4? Well, let's say D is 4, okay, which is still okay, right? Right. Then I think the operator that you want is, so this is a 2-qubit Hilbert space, right? And so we have 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, etc. Right. So this, we put ones here, and we put ones here, and then so right. Okay. But there is a condition that happens when your dimension is too small, that you don't have some elements. Or yeah, so maybe I should write that this assumes for k less than or equal to d. Okay. So now let's derive these formulas. I have 13 minutes, that should be perfect. So let's study k equals 1. So for k equals 1, we need to, so the procedure will be, we'll first compute q, and then we'll write down what the formula is for the integral in question. So for k equals 1, we have only one element, so just the identity. So looks like this, it should be obvious or not. So we have just the identity, and then we take the trace. So that gives us D. So this equals D, and so that implies that the twirl of har A is equal to 1 over D times the trace of A, which is what would happen if you put an A in here contracted with JK, that would agree with that formula. So count this as driving this. So now let's study a non-trivial example. Let's take K equals 2. So here we need to find a non-trivial Q. So there's two elements, there's identity and swap. They're the ones I discussed over there. So I did this calculation over here for you guys. So if you do identity twice, it's the same as doing identity, so we get d squared here. If you do swap and then identity, it's the same as just doing a swap, so we get the d here. We get d here as well. If you do two swaps, you're back where you started, so that's the same as identity. So this is the Q matrix, and that means that Q inverse is equal to a thing that, well, here, I'll just write it. And so, oops, note this blows up if D is 1. So this was what I was saying before, that there's implicit assumption. This is for this to be invertible. There's a condition that K is less than or equal to D. So anyway, so this is Q. And now let's go over here so we can write down explicitly what the form of the twirl is for K equals 2. So we have that for 2, it's 1 over d squared minus 1 I times the trace of A plus S times the trace of S A minus 1 over d S trace of A minus 1 over d identity trace of SA. And so where S is the swap. For K equals 3, it's disgusting. We won't have time to write that out, I guess, similar to over here. So you can sort of understand what these coefficients are now. So basically these first two terms that are leading in the 1 over D expansion, it's basically contracting these two together, or these two together, or the swapped version of that, these two or these two. And then this one involves mixing the indices. So maybe this one and this one over here, but then this one and this one on the other index, and things like that. And so that's basically implicit in this swap and trace structure. So I don't know, this seems a lot more elegant than that. So end of examples. Now, why is this useful? So as I said in the beginning, this is useful if you want to consider a random state. So you want to ask about the properties of random states. And so note, we can basically get a random state if we take A to be, say, the zero state tensor to the K. Oh, sorry. So what is a random state? A random state means you take U and you act on any reference state. It doesn't matter, and this will give you a random state psi. And then you do things with psi. You want to compute some quantity in psi, and then you take a Haar integral. Perhaps I should have started with this observation. So anyway, the twirl is useful because we can take A to B, say the state 0, tensored in the K copies. And so then the twirl of K of this guy is going to give you basically access to K moments of a random state. Right? So it's a random state copied K times. And so you can then do things like take, well, anyway, so that this is one reason why it's useful. So in particular, the second moment that we wrote down here takes a very simple form. And we're going to use that in a second. So it just gives you 1 over d, d plus 1, I plus s. So it's actually a lot nicer. So, right, compared to that ugly thing with the indices that I wrote in the beginning. So now we can prove something called Page's theorem, which I think Daniel is going to talk about. Maybe, I guess he's got one or he'll talk about eventually. But it's pretty much the first reason and maybe the only reason why you need this technology. So maybe this everything we did is overkill, but it's a really nice result. And it says basically that the entropy of a subsystem that's less than half the size of the total system basically looks completely random. The words I used there made no sense. If you consider a random state and you look at a subsystem, then that subsystem is going to look almost completely random, or alternatively, it's going to have maximal entropy. We're going to use the looking random version of that. I will make the statement of it since it's a theorem. I guess I did promise there was going to be one theorem, but I guess there's two theorems. So the theorem, but this is not math. So, well, I guess it is math. I'm confused about what this is. Maybe this is physics or something. So Page's theorem. For any bipartite Hilbert space, I'm running out of time. HA tensor HB with the state rho being random, or a state that's Haar random, then the trace distance between rho sub A, so where I trace out a complement to the identity or the maximally mixed state, is less than or equal to some things that depend on. So here, these are the dimensions of A and B, these things that I'm writing. It'll be obvious once I move out of the way, which is usually written in the following way, which has a best interpretation being thought of in terms of qubits. So if A has lowercase a qubits and B has lowercase b qubits, then this is 2 to the a minus b over 2. And so if B is larger than A, so the full thing is on AB, we trace out B, we take a random state, we trace out B, and we compare that to the identity, and we see that if B is bigger than A by any amount really, then it's exponentially small. Then this trace distance is exponentially small, which means that it's basically completely mixed. In fact, I will tell you now, so the trace norm basically characterizes, I think if the trace norm is less than epsilon between two operators, then that implies that the experimental outcomes differ by at most epsilon over 2. I think that's right. Someone could correct me but basically it tells you how distinguishable two density matrices are. Okay, I need to add one more math statement. So, does everybody know what the trace norm is, or the one norm is? Is that defined in your, okay, good. So, and the two norm, everyone's cool with that also? Great. So you guys also probably know this fact, but the two norm is less than or equal to the one norm of an operator, is less than or equal to the rank of the operator, square root of the rank of the operator, times the two norm. So you can use the two norm to bound the one norm, put an upper bound on the one norm, and we need that where we're going. And I have a minute. So I might go over by like 3 minutes if that's okay, or feel free to jump ship. So we have, so define row A is where we trace out B on this random state. Okay, and what we want is du rho A minus I over A. We want the one norm of this, but nobody ever computes one norms despite that being what you want, because they're not well behaved, nice or nor nice things to average over. So instead, what we do is we square this. And we say that this is less than this, where we bring the square inside the integral. We're allowed to do, right, so this is called Jensen's inequality, or basically just the fact that x squared, the norm of x, or the average of x squared is greater than the variance is always greater than the square of the mean. So that's a fact. And so that the same thing is going on here. We can bring the square inside the integral at the result of a greater than or equal to. Then we can get another one by using this fact about trace norms. So we get that we get a factor of A out here, and du rho A minus I over A. So this is a two norm squared, and the last like three steps, whatever, just right here. So let's evaluate this thing inside here. So we want rho A minus I over A two norm, that's trace A of rho A minus the identity over A squared. Like that. There's some algebra which you can complete at home. This is going to be equal to trace of A rho A squared minus 1 over the dimension of A. In doing this, you have to use the fact that that rho A is a pure state, and so that its trace by itself is 1. Otherwise, it's straightforward. So using this fact, I'm going to erase this right now so I can continue this, but hopefully you got that. So using this fact, we show that this is equal to, or we can just continue this, saying this is greater, less than or equal to A du trace of A rho A squared minus 1. So let's do that over here. I'll take one more minute. Apologize for going over. So so we want to compute this guy here. So writing that out, it's du trace of A times, or open bracket, trace of B u0 u dagger, trace of B u0 u dagger. And so how do we get this from the thing that we know? The thing we know is up there with this twirl thing. This seems different. So when you're confused about things like this, the best thing to do is always draw a picture. So we have, the thing we have is this. So let me just clarify. These lines are the A and B subsystems, right? So that's what the thing we know. We know how to compute this, right? We know how to compute the average of the twirl where we insert this thing, this zero state copied. So it's the average of this thing. The thing we want is going to be this. Well, it's what I will write right here. So let's make things easy on ourselves. Let's actually call the top line B and the bottom line B. So it's not, it's reflected on this line. So we trace out B first. So that's what this means. And then we contract these operators together. So we draw a line like this. And then we take the trace over A. So we draw a line like this. So what that means is that we basically want to take a trace of this guy where first we put a swap on A. So we put a swap on A like this, and then we take a trace and we get this picture below. So that means that we have this expression up here. So the way we get the answer we want is we put a swap on A and then we take a trace. So this swap, by the way, permutes the two subsystems. The swap on A is a different thing, so we can draw a picture really quickly. So we want to do that thing I just said. So we want to understand first how you do it on, this is, I'll just do it over here. So we just need to understand two cases. So first on the identity, so we have, here's A1, here's A2. I'm choosing to write them in a way that's convenient. Here's B1, here's B2. And so what I just said is we do a swap on A, and then we take a trace. And so that's the picture we get for I. So this is equal to dimension of B squared times the dimension of A. The other option is that we need to understand how this works for S. So here, S involves, we start with A1, A2, B1, B2. So this S, this is the S that permutes everything. So it's a swap on A and a swap on B. But then we want to understand the way we get the thing we want is we take an additional swap on A and then take the trace of everything. And so doing that, this is going to be equal to dimension of A squared times B, which means that this whole thing over here is going to be equal to, and then we have to input these dimension dependent factors over there. So where D is equal to A times B. So we have A times B plus 1 times A times B, the denominator, times B squared A plus A squared B. Now, if you take the time to simplify that and plug it back in here, you will see you've derived exactly this expression, and that's the answer. So you're able to use this higher technology we've developed to show that the entropy of a subsystem that a subsystem looks almost completely maximally mixed, and you were able to do it without resorting to going to any index notation. That's it. Thanks. Sorry, that was fast. Are there questions? Yeah.
Do you approximate this hard coiling with the discrete subset, like regroup, let's say?
Yeah, that's correct. So a reason for caring about this operator here is that if you find a finite subset that reproduces the twirl, the k-fold twirl for k for all choices of operators, then that's called a k-design. And so you can do that with a finite. So like the Cliffords on d-dimensional systems are two designs. And so here we only needed the second. We only need the second one, right? So that means that, yeah, for instance, the Cliffords can do this. So when people, a lot of times people talk about this page thing as a definition of scrambling. It's sometimes referred to, and the fast scrambling paper was referred to as page scrambling. And there was some discussion of whether that's a strong condition or not, and so forth. So basically, you don't actually need the full power of a Haar random unitary in order to see this sort of either entropy of a subsystem effect or distance. But if you were to then inspect other properties of the state that depended on higher moments of view, you'd need higher designs. So you just have to ask a more complicated question.
So these questions about Cliffords, they're kind of a really small subset.
That's right.
There is something
to be
said, and Clifford gates are classically efficient.
That's right.
So could we get some intuition about the physics when
you
only use two design or less?
Depending on your, you can think of a circuit built from, say, a particular, a circuit built by iterating, say, a particular Clifford gate. Maybe that is like a perfect tensor. Consider a circuit that looks like, so this is a unitary where, say, time is flowing down, and each of these, it should be a flat tiling, and each of these x's is a tensor that's, say, taken from the Clifford group. I want a particular one that has perfect tensor properties, but maybe that's not terribly important. It's the same tensor at every point.
Okay.
Yeah, and this has the property that basically if you can ask the same question that we asked here, basically by fixing a state here and looking at the averages of these things. The reason that the state starts looking mixed is that if I have some sort of, say, if I insert some sort of operator living over here, the circuit has this property that it gets spread outward. So the operator grows, basically. This is a one way of understanding scrambling, that operators grow. However, the Cliffords have the property that they map poly operators to poly operators. And so you basically just get a string of poly operators that might have support on some large part of the system. So if you trace over, basically, or put it another way, you can think of this as just injecting some input state up here that has some bits, some information confined to this region, and then you want to ask, where does that information end up? That's the same question as the page question. And page tells you that if you consider too small a system, then you get no information because it's distributed non-locally. And so in this case, the Clifford circuit is taking your simple operator Z, maybe that lives on site one, and mapping it to a string of operators. Sorry, this should be 3, 4, et cetera. It's mapping it to some string of poly operators. But in general, a very complicated operator will be like a sum of these strings, a superposition of these strings. And Clifford circuits can't create that. And so having a probe, basically you need some sort of probe that can test for something like that, that doesn't just care about whether the operators have leaked over. I don't know. That's maybe one source of intuition. But I mean, the main point is that the sort of thing that's happening when we create these random states, or the sort of things where so you can imagine that this circuit is a substitute for you that's creating your random state. So you're starting with a particular state, which is like the zero state, which maybe involves just having one, like the Z operator on the first site and everything else the identity or something like that. It's some simple site, some simple reference thing. And this circuit that you apply is supposed to create something scrambled or random, or, right, something random. And in this case, we see that it's not creating as much randomness as you might have expected, because the generic operator is going to be much more complicated than this. And yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
So going back to that number there, so the number two there, is that exactly the same as the thing on top?
This.
Yes.
No, this is slightly more general, I guess, because I assume the twirl form. So it assumes, right? So this is just four unitaries sitting next to each other. In the other case, I assumed that there's some operator here that these guys are contracted with. But the point is that you can, from the twirl, basically derive any property that you want. So for instance, in most cases, this is the only thing that usually the thing I see people use is things like this, trying to estimate one norms, in which case you end up needing something like this, and you can derive that from the twirl in the way that I shown. There's actually a bunch of you can derive formulas for like arbitrary k moments if you think about things in the right way, like explicit formulas. Anything else? All right, cool. Thanks.